Any questions? All right. So we're going to switch gears now and talk about advertising. Okay, so much of our class is about marketing in the digital age, and it's not specifically about paid advertisements. It's about using social media to connect with your customers or offer service or build the brand. But of course, a big part of digital marketing is in that paid advertising. There's still opportunities there, and that's what we're going to talk about today on a very broad level as an overview. Your slides are flip-flop, so I apologize. But when we're talking about paid advertising, there's really kind of three categories in the digital world that the advertisements fall into. The first is search advertisement, paid search, and this we've talked about ad nauseum. This is when you bid on keywords for various search engines. And so, you know, we've talked about that enough. We won't talk about that again today. The second category is display ads. Now, as much as I mock display ads and think that they're useless, there is some real value there in display ads in a few ways. One, just brand recognition. So much like a billboard on the side of the Beltline is something you might not consciously remember seeing, it does work in some ways, right? So that just getting your brand out there, there's value in that. And we're seeing now that there's some real power in targeting your display ads that make them more valuable. And so they're not dead. I think that I'm constantly surprised as I research for this class semester after semester that the display ad is still alive and well, but it is. And it can take many different forms. So there's the pop-up ads. Once you're on a website that pop up, we all know and hate those. There are the banner ads, which are on the top or side of your web page. Now there's this new category of display ads on mobile. So maybe it's at the bottom of your screen, or maybe it's a pop-up on your mobile. Then there's display ads on social. So, for example, on Facebook, there's a whole sidebar of advertisement, right? And there's also can be paid ads in the feed of say Facebook or Twitter. And those sometimes social ads that are paid fall under the umbrella of native advertisement. Sometimes they don't. We'll talk more about that. But in general, display ads on social are, on the side. Think about them on the side of Facebook. And then there's, of course, video ads, which we'll talk about as really growing in popularity. And then the next category of types of ads is native advertisements. So this is on social when you see something that's promoted, a promoted post, but it looks like it's in your feed and it looks like all the other items in your feed. So it looks like a regular tweet, except for this tiny little thing that says promoted, right? Or Facebook or Instagram. So there's that type of native advertisement. And then there's also content that's native, that's promoted, sometimes called advertorial. And we'll talk more about both of those in detail. So that's just to give you an idea of what we're talking about. Just so that we're all on the same page and kind of understand the players in the industry of advertising, we'll go through these. Publishers are basically the people who have a website and are selling that real estate. So they're website owners who are selling space on their site for ads. Or they're, BuzzFeed who is selling space. They're selling sponsored content, an article, right? But they're the people who have websites. The advertisers are the people who are advertising a business, right? So they buy space on a publisher's website, and then they put an ad there. And they pay for each ad unit delivered. And we'll talk about some of the pricing models in the next slide. There's also ad networks and ad exchanges, which are very similar, but different in one main way. So an ad network is basically a third party who takes the landscape of all of the real estate available out there, and then takes the landscape of all the people who want to put ads, and they connect them, right? So Google does this. Google will, we know AdWords because we worked inside it on the keyword planning tool, but that's for the advertisers. They go into AdWords, they create their ad, and they tell you what keywords they want to focus on. And so it can either be in the Google search results, but there's another option you can use in Google Ads, which is that it'll be on publishing partners. And so a website about, let's say, motorcycles, right? If you are selling motorcycles, a website on motorcycles, the publisher may auction off some of that space. And so you can, Google will put your ad on that publisher's website. So at the heart of an ad network is that there's a third party and there's not a lot of transparency. Like we saw with Google, they give you an idea about the cost, an estimated or suggested cost per click, but the real costs are a little bit hidden from you, and that's because there's a third party in the middle of it. Whereas ad exchanges are very similar, except that they're more transparent. And so the advertisers can actually get in touch with the publishers through an auction format. So a publisher, this motorcycle website example, the motorcycles.com might say, I'm selling a display ad for the month at this price. And then the publishers come to the ad exchange. They see that there's an auction on that real estate, and then they bid. So it's a little bit more transparent because even though it is a third party, the information between buyer and seller or advertiser and publisher is more open. And it's typically auctioned, the auction is typically by cost per impression, which we'll talk about in a minute. And then finally, there's the ad affiliates. So this is another sales channel available to businesses where basically a website will refer you some business, and because of cookie tracking, they know that that visitor came, or that customer came from your website, and so they'll give you a cut of the profits. Now, this can be a very small scale. This can be, like, for example, I have my own website. I blog on there every once in a while. I write about books a lot, books that I read and books that I like. And so I'm an Amazon affiliate. All of you could do the same thing. So if somebody reads about a book on my website, clicks on the title, goes to Amazon and buys it, I make 4% of whatever the price is. It's not a lot of money, right? But if you were, because I'm a very small publisher, if I was a bigger publisher, if I had more traffic, if I was a lifestyle blog, for example, with hundreds of thousands of visitors, and I sent that kind of traffic to Amazon, I'd be making a lot more money. So it's another sales channel, which is basically a publisher, but without, they don't sell advertising, they sell, they have a link with embedded code to a certain website. So we're going to talk a lot more about ad affiliates on Wednesday when we talk about the eBay case, because that whole case centers around affiliates. And you're categorized basically on how you drive traffic. So do you drive sales traffic? You can pay differently. Basically, you could pay for sales, customers. You could pay for lead generation. There's different pricing models in that, and we'll talk again more about that on Wednesday. So those are the, kind of the main players in the ecosystem. Any questions about these? Or okay. Now, what's the pricing models? How do you pay for advertisement? So some of these we've already seen in the big skinny case. There's cost per impression or cost per mille, which is cost per impression but measured in thousands. And that's basically how many people are shown your ad. It doesn't necessarily mean that they paid attention or that they even noticed it, but it was shown on their web page, right? Then there's cost per view, which is very similar to impression, but it's specifically for pop-ups or pop-unders, which are basically the same thing. If you close your browser and suddenly there's this new web page open that you don't remember opening, that's a pop-up, a pop-under. But so cost per view is for those pop-ups. Although it's very similar to cost per impression. Then there's cost per click, which we know very well from the big skinny case. Basically, you only pay when somebody clicks on your advertisement. There's also cost per action, and these are a little bit more sophisticated. Cost per action is more sophisticated than cost per click. It requires a higher level of tracking, and so it's going to be more expensive. Your gut will tell you that, and you would be right. But you can do, an advertiser might pay when the visitor does a certain action. So if they fill out a form, a lead form, or they make a purchase, or they watch a video they're hoping they watch, they engage in a poll, or some other predefined action, you can pay for that, so a cost per action. Again, this is going to be much more expensive. Your cost per action is going to be more expensive than cost per click, which is going to be more expensive than cost per impression because you're getting more of what you want. Yeah, Katie?
Would an example of that be the ads on YouTube if you didn't skip it?
Yeah, so that's a good question. That would either be cost per action or maybe cost per time because I think that would be a cost per action because it was somebody who actually watched the whole video. Yeah, I bet that's how they measure it. That's a good example. Cost per time is actually about the final one, which is basically you show it for a certain amount of time. So you show it for a certain amount of days or weeks, and you pay you pay for it to be displayed unlimited times during that time period. So maybe you get the top banner ad on a website, and it's only you. They don't rotate it, but you pay for the amount for the time that it's there. And that usually comes with some sort of guarantee of minimum impressions because of what the publisher knows about their traffic. They say, "Oh, we get 100,000 visitors every day, so you can assume that you'll have that a minimum amount of impressions." Any questions on the cost models? Okay. One of the trends that you guys will hear a lot about once you get into the industry is programmatic advertising. So most big companies these days use programmatic advertising. They'll say, "Oh, we do programmatic buys," or "we do programmatic ads." And that's basically that they've signed up with a company that offers software that will do it for them. So that you tell the software certain things about who you want to target, what time of day, how much you want to spend, and the software that will then take it the next step, find you the publisher, determine when to show your ads. Whereas the previous, pre-programmatic, the alternative is having a person do that, having a person do some of the manual choosing, figuring out where to publish, negotiating, doing manual orders. So we're really seeing this trend towards programmatic buys because it's cheaper because there's not a person, and so it's much more scalable for the company that offers programmatic buying. You know, one piece of software can serve 1,000 different companies, but one single ad buyer could not serve 1,000 different companies. So it's definitely cheaper. It's more efficient in many ways as well because it's software, so it can do some of the metrics and calculations much quicker. And it's always on. So with humans, if one of them is sick, you really need to talk to them. They're not at work that day. That's not the case with programmatic. So again, this is just, the use of software to purchase digital advertising. It's something I started hearing, 4 or 5 years ago, more and more. Like my, guest speakers for this class would come in and say, "Oh, we're shifting towards programmatic," and now I hear it a lot. So just kind of a trend to be aware of. So again, even though I'm shocked that there's still value in display advertising, there certainly is. This is evidenced by the fact that people are still spending money on it. And there are some firms where they focus exclusively on display advertising and make a lot of money helping clients do that. So a few of the reasons that we know there's value in display advertising is one that you can really target your audience. So even if it is just a billboard, right? If we're using the billboard on the Beltline example, it's a billboard, but you're showing it to people that you know are potential customers. And so if there is that branding effect, you're at least showing it to the right people, you could say. So the real power in display advertising is because there's so much data about people online, is that you can target and narrow very efficiently about who you're showing. So go through a couple of these ways that you can narrow your audience and how you can target them. We'll talk specifically about a few more in more detail about a few of them that are kind of confusing. So first of all, there's contextual targeting, which is that you choose where to place your ad based on the type of content. So you care what the article is about. You don't care who's looking at it. Let's say, for example, you're selling American flags and you want to show your advertisement on any article that's about the 4th of July, right? You don't care who's looking at the article. Whereas behavioral is focused on the user. That is targeting based on what you know a web user is doing online. The searches that they've been doing, the type of articles that they read, maybe the other retailers that they visit. There's a ton of data out there. So behavioral, you care a lot about the user. you want to show that flag advertisements to people you know are maybe families of military and are have an interest in patriotic articles. I mean, that sounds absurd, but I bet that there's a way to target that way. So with behavioral, you care more about the person than the content. Whereas with content, you care about more about the article or the page that they're looking at. And I'll show you guys an example in a little bit to kind of clarify that. Then there's retargeting. That's when you show somebody an ad based on a previous visit to your website. This is basically why if you go to Amazon, you search for a certain book, then you go on to thenewyorktimes.com, and all of the ads that you see are of that book, like are a link to that book on Amazon, right? That's called retargeting. And we'll talk more about that in detail. Yeah, Trent.
How well does that work? Because I feel like it always shows me things that I already bought.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
Maybe it's just something I'm noticing.
No, I think that's a good question. We'll actually talk about a kind of a way for companies to prevent that, but I think it does work. I think because so many firms are specializing in it, it must work. So my gut tells me if you took a control group of people who did searching and weren't retargeted versus people who searched and were retargeted, the conversion rate or purchase rate would be much higher when they were retargeted. And for businesses, there's some assurance that, one, these are interested buyers and that they'll do it on their site and not go somewhere else, you know, if you keep showing them that. But certainly that is an issue. But we'll talk a little bit in a couple slides about how you can prevent that. Thanks for bringing that up. Any other thoughts? Okay. So a couple other ways that you can target is by user's interest category. So what types of things are they interested in? Either explicitly through their likes or filling out, you know, interest category forms on pages or on sites like Facebook, or just interests that have been assumed because of the types of things they look at online, right? So if you go to google.com dashboard, which we've talked about in a previous lecture, that will give you an idea of what Google thinks your interest categories are based on the types of things you're doing online. Geographic and language, you can target users by where they are and what language they look at the web in. Demographic targeting, so their age, their gender. You can also target your ad based on the placement that it shows on the website. So if you want to place it above the fold, you know, in the old newspaper days, right, above the fold literally meant that it was above the fold. It was on the top half of the paper. Now above the fold in the digital world means that it is at a place in the website where they won't have to scroll to see it. You can also target based on days of the week or hours of the day, so you can schedule your ad. So if you know that you're target is a night owl for some reason, then you can specifically target that time of day. You can also cap based on frequency. So if you know that your target market actually will fatigue of seeing your ad after 7 times of seeing it, you can cap it at 7, right? So that's another way that you can narrow your focus. And then you can also make exclusions. So you want your display ad shown on all websites related, you know, any websites related to motorcycles, as an example, except for these 3 because those are your biggest competitors. And you know that it doesn't make sense to show your ad there. So these are a few of the valuable targeting strategies you can use in display ads. Let's talk a little bit about content versus behavioral because that distinction can be confusing. So as an example, let's say that your DSW, Designer Shoe Warehouse, you want to show this display ad for to consumers. If you're looking at a contextual targeting strategy, then you would just say, okay, bazaar, I want to show my ad on this web page. I don't care who's looking at it. I don't care what we know about them, but it's just important that it always shows with this ad. Whereas if you're looking at a behavioral strategy, you would say, okay, I want users who have shopped or who have searched for shoes in the last week. They've visited sites like Zappos, DSW and maybe Amazon shoe department in the last week, and they're also interested in fashion, right? Then that user, the ad company that's helping you, right? They target that user, but then they see that, okay, that user just went to read this article about the honey badger, right? Which has nothing to do with shoes, but they know enough about the user that they'll still show the ad because they care about the user, not the content. So you can have them very separate. You can do contextual and or contextual or behavioral. There's, of course, if you're willing to pay more money, you can do a little bit of both. But at the essence, that's the difference. One, contextual cares about the content, so the article, whereas behavioral cares about the individual user, what they've been doing online. Does that make sense? Okay. Another one I want to talk more about is retargeting, which is actually similar to behavioral because it cares about what the person's done online, but it's much, much more specific than just targeting them about their general online behavior. It's basically targeting someone who has already come to your site and looked at a specific product. So this is why if you, like I mentioned, if you, let's say at the beginning of the school year, you're looking for certain textbooks online, and then you start seeing them in all of your display advertisements if you don't have a web blocker or ad blocker. But that's retargeting, right? So a potential customer comes to your site as, you know, they leave without checking out. Later, they surf the web, and your ad recaptures their interest and brings them back and turns them into customers, right? So that's the idea from the business's perspective of retargeting. Now, there are some issues, and Trent brought up a good one. One of them is that there's frequency. So a single search for an item doesn't mean that you actually want to buy that item, right? You can imagine two spouses. One of them is searching on a shared home computer. One is searching for an anniversary gift. One time, logs off, and the next spouse comes in and sees a display ad for that anniversary gift everywhere, right? That's not, you know, they don't want that. And so there's probably certain products, but also certain customers where frequency isn't going to be a benefit. It doesn't actually convert. So, again, these are things that you would learn as you went through the strategy. You would do some A-B testing and see what worked. But these are things that you want to consider from the beginning. And as marketers, you would most likely be working with a firm. If you work in a big company, you'll be outsourcing sort of you'll be working with a digital advertising firm that has the technology that can do these things. Or maybe you'll actually, you know, as marketers, be working for the firm. But either way, these are the things you want to either talk to your clients about or as a client, talk to your ad rep about so that you can make decisions around them. The second is the burn code or burn pixel, and this is what Trent brought up. So if you've already purchased, why waste money on that customer? That's a waste of your money. They've already bought the product. So you can, of course, for an increased fee, or you just find a firm that offers a standard, but you can include some code in the advertisement so that if they've bought the product, you won't show it to them anymore. Then there's the idea of segmentation. So if they looked at a very specific product and then you show them that product over and over again, that may work. For some businesses, it might make more sense to just show them general things from your website. So I know from experience, like Macy's, they don't segment. So if you look at a certain pair of shoes on Macy's.com, at least this is what happens for me. I don't know if this is their strategy for all customers. If I look at shoes on Macy's.com, I will then go and see all their display ads that are retargeting me, but it's not always for shoes. Sometimes it's for women's clothes. Sometimes it's for purses. Sometimes it's for men's clothes. So it's just really for their store. So again, this is something you want to think about. It costs more to segment, but maybe it's worth the cost because it just converts so much better. Or maybe it doesn't. Maybe you're somebody like Amazon where you know if you can get them there for one product, they're going to buy a whole basket full of products, and so maybe it doesn't make sense. And then finally, there are some companies with doing some interesting things around kind of tracking technology where they can actually track whether or not seeing the ad made that person buy, even if they didn't click on it. So they embed, again, cookies into the ad, and they know they can track the customer over a certain maybe 30 days. So they know that the customer bought it, but they also know that they didn't click on that ad. So they can make hypotheses about whether or not seeing that ad made them buy. Mm-hmm. Claire?
Kind of went along with that and the burn code.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a way for companies to know if I was searching shoes on Macy's, but then I bought them from Amazon? Is there any way for Macy's to know that? Does it not waste the money on me, or there's no way for them to know that?
I think there is, because I'm sure that your whole purchase on Amazon being tracked is being tracked, right? So they see that you go to add to cart, they see that you click. And so a third-party firm would have access to that data.
Okay.
So that's like that's the value of working with a third-party firm is that Macy's doesn't have access to that data necessarily, but a third-party firm might because they kind of aggregate that purchase data from the web.
Got it.
Any other questions? Yeah, Connor.
Who do they buy that data from?
So there's a whole bunch of companies that embed cookies or pixels on websites to track us, Google being one of them, Facebook being another. But a third-party firm will buy data from Facebook, buy data from Google, and try to aggregate it. And those are the big players that we would recognize. There's hundreds of others that do the same thing. There's this browser add-on that I use on Chrome I forget the name of it, but I could bring it in. But it basically shows you every time you're on a website how many different people are tracking your behavior on that website. And it's like every time I go to a website, it's dozens of them. So it's not just the big players that we think. There's people all over who are making deals with publishers to add this tracking code to collect that data. Lindsay?
So with retargeting and behavioral, it's like it's collecting your one person's specific data and then, putting it on, whatever website they think that you would see, or just, in general, all these types of people who have looked at this also, a majority of them also go to this website, so we'll place the ad there also.
No, it's specific to the user. So, again, if you work with, a third-party ad network, they might be buying ads on thousands of different publishers' sites, so they know they can track you as an individual. Okay, you're on the New York Times now, and we buy property there, so we're going to buy it. That's why this programmatic buying is so quick. It can be real time. They can say, this user just went to the New York Times, now they went to BuzzFeed, now they looked at, SI.com, and on each of those sites, we buy that space, and so we're going to show the same ad for, the boots that they looked at Macy's. Now, behavioral is a little less specific because they might say more, in general, we want users who searched for shoes in the last 30 days, and they might not get down to the very specific individual user. Retargeting is more expensive because of that, because you do retarget individuals that have a purchase intent, or that you hypothesize have a purchase intent because they were on your website looking at a specific product.
For your previous example of the Honey Badger website, that seems like a really specific website that maybe one person who was also looking at shoes looked at.
Right.
That's why I was
Yeah, so with that example, you would tell your ad agency or ad network, right? You would tell the ad network, okay, these are the kind of people I want to target. And that network has identified those users and then displays the ad to those users on the websites that they're looking at if they buy ad space on those websites. So with the example of the Honey Badger user, we would just make an assumption that the ad network bought, that was one of the publishers that they had to deal with. And typically ad networks, that's why publishers, very, very rarely does a publisher work with just one advertiser. They will typically go, for example, there's, lifestyle blogs. There's some lifestyle, certain networks that focus on lifestyle blogs, but they will focus on thousands of them. So if you're Target, you want to get your new spring collection out for housewares, you work with that network specifically. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I just have one more follow-up.
Yeah.
For behavioral, for retargeting, it's just that one specific person will see that ad, if me and Zach are on the same website, he would see a different ad in that same spot.
Yep.
But for behavioral, is that the same thing? Right.
You would likely, if you and Zach don't have the same profile of, browsing, you would likely see, if you didn't see a retargeted ad, you would still likely see different ads on that same website. Now, if you had very similar online behaviors, might see the same ad, but most likely you would see different ads. Yeah, Trent.
Do they track you by the individual device, or if you're signed into your Gmail, then would it be, if I'm signed in my Gmail on my phone all the time and my computer, is it then
right?
That?
That's a really good question, and one of the major challenges that the industry faces today, which is how do we track people who use different devices throughout the day and aren't signed in on all of them. Some companies make it, or there are some businesses that make it easy. So Google has done that. If you're signed into Google on your phone and on your laptop and on your tablet, then they're pretty sure you're the same person. They can track you on all your devices. But some people don't do that, right? Some people don't stay signed in, or maybe they don't use the same browser on their phone as they would on their computer. And so that's definitely a big challenge. I think we'll continue to see technology coming out around that. A few of the things that they're working on or that are available now, I just want to make sure I get this right. So again, like logging into Chrome, for example, if you want to customize your Chrome, that's a great opportunity for Google because they can then follow you on all of your devices. Same with Gmail, same with, you know, other email providers as well. But we also see like social logins. That's why everybody is offering you the option to log in with Facebook, because then they can not only gather your information while you're on the site, but all the information that Facebook has on you, which is from your interactions on Facebook, but all those other sites that you use to log into. So that's why, like, if you're on the Huffington Post reading an article and there's like a little Facebook thing and it says, oh, these friends read this article, share the article or something, that basically lets you know, okay, Huffington Post also is tracking me via their relationship with Google. iOS is working on making that improvement so that they can track people along devices so that they'll eventually log into iOS in the same way you do, say, Google Chrome. So we're seeing innovations in the market, but it's definitely one of the biggest challenges is tracking people on different devices. It's a good question. Right now it's imperfect, so if you could solve that problem, you could do well for yourself in the market. Any other questions? Great questions, you guys. All right. Another trend that we really are seeing a lot in display ads is video ads. Just a few weeks ago at a technology summit, that Facebook's head of ad product, Ted Zagat, said a year or two from now, most of Facebook will be videos. And so, and of course, he has this ad perspective, but what, you know, I think the revenue model is driven by how users are using Facebook. So we know as Facebook users, too, that we're seeing more and more videos in our feed, and that's intentional. Facebook is doing that. Well, one, video use is exploding. Everybody has so many people have a smartphone, they can capture it on their phone, but also, you know, Facebook is giving priority to videos. So between all of the Facebook properties, which are Facebook, WhatsApp, this one I don't know, does anybody know this one? I don't know, a chat maybe? Maybe that's what chat is. Nobody knew in the last class either. Something. And Messenger, Instagram, these are all Facebook properties, right? But between the five of those, they have 4 billion video views a day. So it's a significant part of what we're doing online is watching videos. And we're going to see that grow. So as aspiring marketers, if you're into the creative side and want to think about how you can create ads, it might make a lot of sense to get video creation skills because we're going to see more and more of that. A couple of things that we're noticing about video ads. So the number of ads that are streamed have grown, especially by older adults. And interestingly enough, adults 55 and older now stream more ads than 18 to 34-year-olds. The early adopters, who are usually young, are now being surpassed by... That's when you know something's becoming mainstream, is when your parents are doing it, right? Lindsay? I think part of it might be that. Part of it is like the auto-streaming function of Facebook, right? I'm sure those are counted as streams in some ways, and we don't always even listen to those. But yeah, I do think there's this element of savviness, for sure, of the user. Yeah. Yeah, Quinn. I think it's to, I don't know that answer, but my guess is that it's to get us used to watching videos online because they want to show us more video ads. And maybe that's what they see that users are doing anyway. You know, they're always testing, they're always doing that A-B testing. So maybe they see that people really enjoy and interact with videos more than they would written content or photo content. But I always am very skeptical, and so I always think like, well, how they're probably doing this to make more money eventually. It's a good question. Video ads are being streamed for longer. It's still very short, but we're doing it longer. This is really recent data from the last year, June 2014 to 2015. And you don't have to worry about these specific numbers, but just understand kind of the trends. Yeah, Claire.
On YouTube and stuff, when you watch a video, what counts as increasing the view? Like, do you have to watch from beginning to end to get the view number to go up?
No, you don't. I don't know what the cutoff is, but you definitely don't have to watch the whole thing. That's a good question. I'm not sure exactly what the answer is. But, yeah, and so I'm sure that they, you know, internally keep, like, the companies, like, YouTube would know all of that. They'd know the average amount of time people watched, but probably don't share most of that unless you're paying them to share that with you, right, and you're advertising with them. So even though we're watching more video ads, they're still very short. So 40% of the videos we watch online are ads, but it's still only 6% of the video streaming time. So that gives you an idea. I mean, as someone who did a little Netflix binging this weekend, which I feel like I confess all the time in this class, but, you know, House of Cards and me, we've been really getting to know each other. I spent, like, hours watching House of Cards. I didn't have to watch one ad. So that might be the disproportionate way, right, how consumers are viewing media very differently now. But also just that, you know, we watch more ads, but we watch, it's still such a tiny part of what we're watching online. Okay, so let's see. We're going to watch a video to kind of kick off our discussion of native ads. And let me see. Okay. It's a long video, but we have time, so we're going to watch the whole thing. It's John Oliver, his take on that native advertising. It's very funny. It'll put you in a good mood. But there is some swearing, so if you're offended by swearing, I'm sorry. They did beep out the F word, but there's some other swears in there. So, all right, so John Oliver puts a very humorous spin on what I think is a real issue, and I want to talk about the ethics around it. But before we do the ethics, I just want to talk around sponsored content in the news. There are other native advertisements that are available to businesses. So one is serialized content. This is when a business sponsors or produces something that consumers consume, like entertainment. So one example is HP did a few years ago, they did like a 10 episode YouTube series following the kind of the behind the scenes of a DJ, Tiesto, electronic music DJ. I mean, that people consumed, like, entertainment. It was interesting to them, but it was sponsored by HP. Another one is meme jacking, where, you know, something's already very popular online, and a company is quick enough and agile enough to kind of jump on the bandwagon. I'll show you a quick example of that that I love because I watch a lot of Sesame Street with my son.
Need to have knowledge on me, mind. It is the chocolate chip kind. Me look at you and me tell. You may have Snickers, do thou. Me drink me soul for a bite. Me spell it out black and white. Me look at you and me see. You like an elf in a tree. You go be showing and me hunger growing. Let's get skin to flowing. We'll start this snack going, baby. Hey, me just met you. And this is crazy, but you got cookies, so share it, baby. It's hard to look at your snack, baby, but you got cookies, so share it, baby.
All right, so when Carly Rae Jepsen's Call Me Maybe was hitting it big, so many brands took advantage of this. Workplaces did it. The UW, the Badgers did it. Abercrombie & Fitch did it. They all made this video to kind of jump on the bandwagon in hopes that it got them some attention. There's also sponsored playlists. So for music sites like Pandora, you can sponsor a playlist. And so Gatorade sponsors various workout types of music, right? And so it's a way to give customers value, but in a sponsored way. And then there's sponsored stories, which we see on social media, like this, for example, on Facebook is a sponsored story. You see that it's sponsored right up here. It's basically an advertisement for Square, the payment processor. We see these on Twitter. We see them on Instagram. And the reason that they're native is because they look like the content that's in your feed already. So Instagram just opened up their ad API and their advertisement opportunities. So I'm sure that you guys have noticed more ads in your Instagram feed. I personally think they all look like ads. I haven't seen one yet that has done well. I think people are still trying to figure out how to do that. But that's an example of native advertising as well. So I just want to spend the last 10 minutes talking about this ethical question that John Oliver raised. Are native ads, specifically when they're in news sources like the New York Times or the Atlantic or other news sources, are they unethical? If so, why? If not, what do we need to do to protect the consumer? Or do we not care at all? Is it because the consumer's smart, we just expect them to make the decisions themselves? So he talks about the Orange is the New Black example, the Atlantic with the Church of Scientology. They caught a lot of flack for that. And of course, no good news story would be complete without an Onion making a joke out of it. They talked about sponsored content from the Taliban as a vibrant and thriving political movement, right? Of course, that's a joke. The Onion is a joke. But I want to hear from you guys. What do you think? Where do you fall on this issue? Is it unethical? Is it a gray area? What do you need to do to assure that people aren't being taken? So I'm sure we could talk about this much longer. I just kind of want to wrap up because class is almost over. But I wish that we had more journalism students in here because we would have a richer debate. I think us as business students, we understand the need to drive revenue and the creative ways to do that. But think about a few things. One, we've talked about the average consumer in this class. They read at a seventh grade level, the average American, right? They read at a seventh grade level. John Oliver points out that half of them don't know these are ads. More than half do not know these are ads. So think about the responsibility, you know, and there's no right answer. This is an ethical question. Some of you are going to believe one thing. Some of you are going to believe another. But think about, do we have a responsibility to the consumers to at least inform them? Does this erode the brand of the journalists or the news outlets? And if so, as marketers, what do you need to do about that? Or is it just something where, you know, it's up to the consumers to educate themselves. We're just doing our job as marketers and sharing things we think might be valuable to them, right? So I just want to bring up the ethical issue because it's something important to think about as you go into the world of marketing. So thank you, guys. Have a great evening. I'll see you on Wednesday.